Hello and welcome to The Sage's Cabin. In this podcast, we'll hear from wisdom keepers of herbal medicines and foods, well-being, gardening and social justice movements. I'm your host, Rox Madeira. I'm a community herbalist, massage therapist, a yoga teacher and run women's circles. I also run a grassroots non-profit supporting refugee and marginalised peoples through growing herbs, herbal medicines, education and well-being, and as a means to improve health and resilience. We also raise awareness of issues around the globe to create understanding, peace and humanity and combat the fear and hostile environment of separation being created. I'm also an ambassador for the Herb Society, which you can join for a low price and find out more about herbal remedies. If you enjoy the podcast, please like, share and subscribe. And consider signing up as a patron. There are three tiers: the supporter, the herbal circle, where you can meet different herbs each season, and Weaving the Feminine, where we work with ancestral journeys and earth magic. You'll find all this on my Patreon, Wise Herbal Ways, or on my website, www.roxmadeira.com. So grab a cup of tea and join me in the Sage's Cabin. In today's podcast, I'm speaking with Christina Stapley, who's an author and a teacher. She has many books and she's also appeared on various TV programs, and her talks are on varying aspects of herb use, both historical and modern. What we're talking about today is going to be about her new book, A History of Plant Medicine, and she's talking about plant medicine from the context of how it is used in Britain. So I really hope that you enjoy the podcast. So if you do, please like, subscribe and share.
Hiya.
I was just busy clicking everything.
I know. Half the time my stand doesn't work. So I was like, I had to go out and come back in again. So I think I'm just going to launch straight into it. But maybe we could start with you just tell me a little bit about yourself and how you got into herbalism.
Okay. Well, it started a very long time ago. I suppose because I grew up with history, my father was an archivist, and I spent a lot of time with him as an only child. The history has always been there. And so that led me into the herbs. And when I was quite young, I started writing a novel set in the Elizabethan period. And so for this novel, we had a witch in it. We had a big house in it. So I needed to know what went on in the still room and what went on in the forest side of things. And so I simply got every book from the library on herbs and went through the bibliographies and kept going. And for 3 years, I made index cards of concentrated information. And then I started a writing course, and that needed me to write articles because they guaranteed you would earn your money back by the end of the course, which I did. And so I wrote about herbs. And so that sort of started things. It went on into talks and then workshops and a series of herb gardens, with the biggest one being a third of an acre, which I had for 20 years as a teaching garden.
And did that book get published?
Well, the novel's still sitting in the garage.
Okay.
Because by the time I'd come to the large garden some years later, I was taking workshops at home and people kept saying, "We can't remember all of this. Would you write it down?" And so I started writing books on herbs. And so they have been published, yes. Number 8.
Oh, do you think you'd go back to that book?
I think possibly when I really retire. I've retired from practice as a medical herbalist now.
Okay.
And downsized. But I'm still growing about 130 herbs in the garden. Which is less than half what I used to. And I'm teaching young students coming up at the School of Herbal Medicine. And that I really love. And so I am still very much in the herbal world, yes.
And did you have a busy practice when you were doing clinics and things?
Well, quite busy because people knew me already with the herbs. We lived in a village, and so the entire village knew me first as the herb lady, to my face anyway. Then it sort of went straight into practice, and my reputation was already established, which was very helpful.
Yeah. And your garden, was that in the village as well? Was that part of the kind of community?
Yes. The garden I had open on garden open days each year. But when I started making it, in fact, the workshops came out of just a couple of people who looked over the fence, and I was actually setting out a knot garden. And so they asked me, would I teach them about herbs? And we'd only just arrived at that point. And so one of them was called Rosemary as well.
Nice.
It seemed rather nice. And I said, well, if you've got some more friends who'd like to know. And they came back a week later. There were seven people all living within 2 miles of the house. And we started doing a day once a month as I was actually laying the garden out. And people brought me plants because they heard about it. And so it was always a case of if I'm not here and you know what you need, just come in and take it. And it was really lovely to feel that it was part of the community.
Yeah, makes sense. And it, at the now, so you've got a book just recently out, which is names out of my head. It's Shift Plant Medicine. And am
Yes.
I right that you do workshops on based on herbal histories? And
I do. Yes, I take workshops nowadays almost exclusively at the Wealden Downland Living Museum in West Sussex, because we used to live fairly near to there, and I've been taking workshops there for the last 25 years.
nice.
A
And
little bit of an established thing. And
yeah,
because
I
there's
like
so
the
much you can do.
yeah, I can imagine. And I like the kind of we don't really ha I don't feel like we have a lot of living history museums up here. You seem to see a lot more down south. I mean, we do have some of, but like it just feels when I'm looking. Can you tell me a little bit more about the book about it?
Yes, I'm very happy to have the book finally finished. I said I was going to write this in about 1994, I think.
Okay.
I was taking workshops at Butts Ancient Farm, and I was asked to go there and think about how the Celts would have used herbs because we don't have the written evidence. And so it was a case of really getting to know living in a roundhouse and what the sort of conditions would leave you needing to treat, amongst other things. Looking at what was growing around the roundhouse, not just now, but in the period just before the Romans arrived, so 2000 years ago. And then putting the two together in a reasonably sensible way. So it was archaeology and archaeobotany, but also my knowledge of the herbs and a lot of applied medicines, because you can see what it does. At that point in time, on the inside of the patient, you weren't able to see what was going on. So you had to just make conclusions. And so we did quite a lot of compresses, poultices. There was always an ointment to take home. And the very first one I took there, Dr. Peter Reynolds, who'd asked me to do it and was in charge, it's an experimental archaeology site. He decided he would thatch over the doorway. So he was actually out of sight, but he could hear every word I said all day. And at the end of the day, he said, I'm very happy for you to keep coming.
test.
And it was to him that I said, I want to write a history of the herbs all the way through, because then you find where things start, how long some recipes last, how they're passed down. And it's just fascinating. So I did quite a lot of groundwork in that period. And then when we came to the year 2000 at the museum and the Wealden Downland, they said, how would I like to celebrate the millennium? And I said, well, I'll be ambitious. I want to follow the use of herbs over the last 1,000 years. So then a lot was put in order for those workshops. And that really is part of was part of the framework of the book that was to come.
So did you try out all the different, like, not all of them, obviously, but like a lot of different recipes from the different
eras? A lot of recipes, yes. And that has been my mission for at least 25 years, to find those recipes that have gone by the wayside but actually work really well. And some of the uses of herbs, for instance, wild celery, apium, as a modern herbalist, you're generally using the tincture and you're using its diuretic qualities. But then I kept finding recipes for swelling. And so this was the leaf being applied either as a compress or in an ointment. And so I made those and I tried them, sometimes on people in workshops, first of all, who were willing, and then on patients. And then I reintroduced that use to other herbalists in a workshop. So this is the way we can really gain from looking at history.
That was one of the questions I was going to ask you, is why do you feel that history is particularly important, especially in herbalism, because that's your field?
I think it's very important. And also to know where our traditions come from and how much is our tradition and how much comes from other places. Because, of course, there's been huge influence. In this country, we have so many instances of being invaded, and the Romans were here for 400 years. And if you look at the herbs that we use in cookery and in medicine, there's a huge range that came from the Mediterranean with them, which completely rewrote what people were doing. And then later on, there's others come. So we've got the Northern European influence with the Vikings, with the Anglo-Saxons as well from Europe. And so the original gets rather swamped, unfortunately, and pushed to the edges.
So, because we always like talk about like kind of native plants that we have here. But I mean, I imagine that like throughout basically most of our history, all if not all of our history, would have been traveling with plants or moving plants or trading plants around. So I don't know, is there plants that we can still kind of think of as that were maybe here first, or which were like the original plants?
Well, I don't know if they made it here first, but possibly. I followed a number of herbs through the centuries in the book. So these are deliberately a mix of native and introduced, but introduced long ago for most of them. So I wanted to follow plantain, greater plantain, and ribwort have been hugely important in the past, and it's such a shame that people see them as weeds nowadays. Ribwort has come more to the fore in modern herbalism, but the greater plantain has had anywhere up to 29 different uses.
Oh, wow.
And it, you know, it is everything. It's diuretic, it's a wound herb, it's antihistamine, it's anti-inflammatory, it's antibacterial. And When you start clocking up all the actions from the constituents, it's not surprising that it had 29 uses. So I've followed plantains through, I've followed nettle through, I've followed betony. And betony is a Celtic herb which the Romans took up from us, or rather from the Gauls. And that's where the name comes from, the tribe. And so we have those. And then I've looked at elecampane, which came with the Romans, the Inula helenium. And that's been really important through the Anglo-Saxon and on. And then ginger and licorice from fairly early. But we really have tended to think of our native herbs a little bit as second best, apart from those really ones that stand out. And people all over the world do that. They all think that if it comes from a long way away,
yeah,
it has to be better.
Yeah.
It's like a cow looking at the grass on the other side of the fence. You know, that has to be better than what I've got here.
Yeah. True. And do you have like a favorite era within all that time?
Medieval, I think.
Okay.
I've always loved the medieval period. I put a whole chapter on medieval pharmacy. And I very much explored lots of recipes from that time. Some of them come through from the Anglo-Saxon, some of them are other influences, but medieval and what comes through from Salerno with the Arabic as well. It's a fascinating period.
And is that because there was a lot of change in as well?
Yes. Yes.
Could you tell me maybe some of the medicines, like how, for example, how they would make an ointment of something?
Well, I make them in a very similar way. I like to use the fire, actually, to make ointments. So I'm using olive oil, which I prefer. It's very good for taking constituents across the skin barrier. And it's been used since time immemorial, almost. Yes, we had olive oil here. We were importing it before the Romans came. And we know that from a find of the amphora with olive oil on the remains of a ship at the bottom of the Thames, and there were coins with it. And so we can date it as before Roman invasion. They did use flax oil as well, and butter. And butter medicines are good. So I have made butter medicines as well. I don't honestly like using lard, which was also used. and I have ointment pots, which are wooden boxes. Now, if you put a butter ointment into a wooden box, of course, the butter, once it cools, goes solid. So you don't need to add anything to stiffen it. That will keep in a wooden box in normal temperatures for 18 months. There's no putting it in the fridge. Yeah. I've taken ointments in the boxes to workshops. And so they've sat by the fire in a roundhouse in the summer. And on one occasion, a lady put her finger in it. And I thought, there goes the experiment. But it still didn't go off. So there's very interesting things to be looked at with containers, as well as actually what you're making the recipe with. And when I make an ointment, I will heat it on the fire with the herb in the oil or the butter. And then I strain it, if it's in the first half of the year, through goosegrass. Or cleavers. Do you know what I mean?
Yep.
Yeah, the sticky herb. Yep. So if you take a lot of stems and you put them laying one way, it's just like making felt. then you put more stems the other way. You can make it like a bowl. You pour the hot oil through and it will take every little bit of herb out of it. And you can squeeze it without burning your hands, and then you put it on the compost heap and you've got no cloth to wash.
That's good. I'm going to try that.
And you get an extraction from the cleavers at the same time.
Yes.
So, yes, it's win-win. And when I was thinking about, well, how would you have done it in a roundhouse? That was one of the things that came to me, because I'd read of shepherds in Greece using it to take hair out of milk. And I thought, if it takes hair out of milk, then definitely.
Yeah, I
and
mean,
why
it's so
wouldn't
prolific,
they?
Isn't it? It just goes everywhere.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's so good.
Interesting.
And I used mullein leaves as pot holders, because again, they're thick, they protect your hands, they grip the pot, and they can go on the compost heap afterwards. And you're not going to set fire to your cloth either.
Yeah, and I guess, like, you know, if cloth was so, I mean, cloth would have been so precious because you spent so much time weaving it and everything.
Exactly. Yes, I am a spinner and weaver, and so, you know, this is something that came to me, obviously, as well, you would think about that.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, and I never even like considered that. And so,
and
like,
sometimes, sorry.
Yeah.
Later on, you find in the recipes, you will find a prayer. And sometimes say the prayer three times when it's on the fire, and maybe when you're stirring it. And that's a timing mechanism. And there's also a timing mechanism in, you find you put it on the fire for a mile way. So that's the time it takes you to walk a mile.
Okay.
Which works out at a good pace, about 20 minutes. And when you're constantly walking in your everyday life, that's something that is sort of in the back of your head, just like, you know, when you've been cooking a lot of years, you don't need to set the timer for something. You know when it's going to be ready.
Yeah.
It's part of your experience. And so you will find things like that as well. And I've gone through those in the book to help people understand when they're, if they go to read recipes, how they can reproduce it.
And so the pot's just, you're just putting the pot directly on the fire, because nowadays we're putting it into like double boilers and trying
I
not
know.
to, you know, not to heat
Well,
it too much and everything.
With an ointment, you're not on the fire, you're at the side of it.
Oh, I see. Right, yeah.
Yeah, so you want hot embers rather than flame. And you can judge, when you've been doing it a while, you judge where to put it.
Yeah.
And most certainly something that I learned, and I put this in the book as well, I soon learned that on a windy day, you don't put it on the side of the fire towards the door. Because I sat there for some time with a group of people watching the wax that I had put into my extract of oil melting on one side of the pot, running to the other, and going solid again.
Yeah.
Just with a cold drab.
No.
So there's an awful lot that you learn by carrying these things through and actually making the recipe.
Yeah. And so would it be beeswax that you would have been using?
Sorry?
Would you be using beeswax? The wax
Yes.
that you talked about. Yeah.
Yes.
Interesting. And so do you have like a favorite recipe that you've discovered?
Oh, now then. Well, there is one for a cough, which again I have put in. And often you are putting herbs into honey. And it is There's one with dill and aniseed in honey with elecampane root, cooked elecampane root. And that is really good and really nice. But one of the ones that I do like and which I used a lot for patients is from the 1700s, if I remember rightly. And you cook elecampane root. So when it's soft, you mash it. You add quite a lot of sugar, which nowadays is a bit frowned on, but it keeps. And then you use aromatic water of hyssop and gum tragacanth. And so you mix your gum with the aromatic water of hyssop. And hyssop is another chest herb, so it goes extremely well with the elecampane. And then you bring it all together and form sweets, fairly small sweets, because elecampane is quite strong. Mm-hmm. And then I dry them on greaseproof paper, turn them over after 24 hours, dry the other side, wrap them individually in greaseproof paper. And those are exceptionally good cough sweets. They keep a long time. I've used them with patients who've been really ill, one with sarcoidosis, bronchiectasis, and asthma patients, people with chest infections. And I stopped saying they could have them several a day when one lady came to a workshop and we were making them. And I gave everybody one before they left. And she said she had had a viral chest infection for 6 weeks. And she had one of these sweets, just one. Before she left, she said, "It feels really warm in my chest." And she came to another workshop a month later. And she said, "You know, when I went home, it felt really warm the whole of the next day. And then I was coughing up all day, and then I was better."
Yeah, well.
And it was one sweet.
Wow.
So after that, I said no more than 3 sweets a day.
That's amazing.
They have always produced, I mean, they've never done a miracle like that again, but it was obviously exactly what she needed.
Yeah.
But they've always proved really, really useful.
I'll need to try and find that recipe in the book. So that kind of, I mean, I think that we sort of current thinking is that people were always quite fairly ill and died really young, kind of historically. Have you found that to be the case, or do you think that's just kind of not true?
It's not in general, it's not true. You can't really make generalizations like that. A lot of the what feeds into the mortality rates is actually huge mortality rate of the under twos, for various reasons at various points in history. And it was really bad when it was customary when a child was teething to lance the gum to help the tooth come through, and very often they died of sepsis. But that mortality is high. And I was very interested. I did a study some years ago of mortality rates. And I have a lot of gentlemen's magazines from the 1700s and into the 1800s. Which was actually a collection that my father made. They're fascinating, and they have the mortality rates for London. So this is not a healthy place to live. And at the end of the year, each month, they give the deaths. And at the end of the year, what they died for, the figures for what they died for, and the ages. And you find that. So if you take out sort of the smallpox outbreaks and things like that, you have, if a woman lives beyond childbearing years, she's likely to live a very long time. I didn't find, actually, that having said that, the huge numbers dying in childbirth that I thought I was going to find. But you've got somebody, often four or five, who are over 100 each month.
Interesting.
So that means
there's
quite
that
a
now?
few
I don't
people
know.
living there. You've got a large mortality at the beginning. It goes down a bit in the twos to fives, and then it's low, and then it's higher, 20 to 30. And a lot of that is consumption. It's pulmonary TB, which has been endemic the whole time. And then later on, the numbers steadily get smaller as you go on from sort of 50 upwards. But it's rare that there isn't somebody over 100 dying. And you've got wonderful obituaries about how many descendants they left, which is enormous in some of them. One woman of 102 had 22 children.
Oh,
and
wow.
then, of course, there's all the grandchildren who went to the funeral, and then the great-grandchildren. And so I've been very interested in ways that people have thought up to help you to live longer. So there's a whole chapter on that, because some of them are quite fascinating, the things that people have thought up. And Francis Bacon is a great source for that. I have his book on the history of life and death, and it's an original, and it gives you such insight as to the way that they were thinking at that point. And he begins the practice of looking at things scientifically, and so he goes through all the steps of looking at how old birds and animals live to be, and how you can think about whether they live longer on land or in the sea. And then he goes to the oldest known living people and compares lifestyles. And it's all very carefully set out. It's wonderful.
Interesting. And what, do you have any examples that you could share of like some
Sorry?
of the ways? Do you have any examples that you could share of some of the ways that you were talking about that people could extend their lives?
Well, one of the less adaptable ideas, shall we say, was that he decided that hermits, and people who were walled up, actually, as hermits, seemed to live longer than other people. And so he decided that if you closed the pores on your body, you were more likely to keep your innate heat in, and therefore you would live longer, which was an interesting idea.
So is that kind of like the kind of hot and cold kind of? So hot opening
Yes,
your pores, cold closing,
it's going,
kind of thing?
Yes,
That
quite with
kind of
the
direction.
Arabic idea of heat is life, and also later on, which it comes through the North American, doesn't it? Heat is life and cold is death. And therefore you have heating things. But also he recommends a number of cordials, which more on the sensible side, of clove pink is one of those. And I love making clove pink syrup. You have to grow them to get the right ones. And that was taken by the settlers going to America for anxiety on the voyage. And there must have been a lot of that. I've given clove pink syrup to patients for anxiety, and it's just beautiful. It smells very strongly of clove and tastes of clove, and it's absolutely calming. It's lovely.
What is clove pink? Is that
it is the not the very tiny cheddar pink, but you grow the Caryophyllus. And they are pink, red, or white flowers, but it smells really strongly of clove. Not all clove pinks do. And I grow them in the garden, And generally, the plant lasts about 6 years.
Okay.
And by the last 2 years, it's giving you possibly towards 100 flowers. So it's a real harvest. And I think there's clove pinks, there's rose, which of course was always used for anxiety as well and bereavement. And I very much have used it in that way. And the orange blossom, the bitter orange. And at the moment, I have a bitter orange tree in my sitting room. It comes every year at the coldest part of the year into the sitting room and it flowers. And it's absolutely beautiful. So it acts as a tranquilizer and it lifts the mood. And the whole room is full of the scent of these beautiful white flowers. It's gorgeous. It's the exact antidote you need February, March time.
Yeah.
I've
Perfect.
got a lemon tree in there as well. It's rather green in my sitting room.
So do you think that it was mostly women that were practicing herbalism, or do you think it was a mix of women and men? And do you think, was it different how women and men practiced?
It's interesting. That's very interesting because I know some people have said to me, well, of course, we lost all the knowledge when the witches were burnt. No, we didn't. So women in that sort of situation of which started in my first novel before I really knew much about it, the woman, the village herbalist is functioning and she is gathering wild. But you also have the once the monasteries are dissolved in the 1500s, then you have the lady of the manor takes it on. And she has a still room because fortuitously, the Virtuous Book of Distillation came into English and was available to them from 1527. So just before the monasteries are dissolved. So the ladies have all the instruction that they need for setting up a still room and how long the waters will keep, how to prepare them, everything that you need. And in 2004, I brought out the receipt book of Lady Anne Blenko, and I know the family. She was treating family, tenants, people round her. And when I talked to Lady Susanna, she remembered, she said her mother-in-law, rather, she married into the family. Her mother-in-law remembered people coming right up to the NHS for treatment. So that carries on through with, not with every big family, but those who were really interested. Carry on treating the people around them. The poor just go to them. And you
Okay.
find in diaries, Margaret Hoby's diary, that she lists, she's reading the Bible, she's reading books, she's entertaining people, and then she gets called to somebody who needs a wound dressing. And he's just come to the door. And she goes and does it and then goes back to her entertaining.
Yeah.
So you've got the ladies at that end, where in the chapter where I've gone across to America with the settlers in the book, and I did go to Plymouth Plantation Museum in 2011, and I took workshops there, which was fabulous. Then it was ministers' wives, ministers of religion were encouraged to marry a woman who knew about herbs. So that she would treat the parishioners.
Okay.
And that follows on through. But you've got the leech, you've got the physician and the surgeon. The physician goes to university and is almost above seeing people by the time he's done his 14 years of training, which is not very practical at all. You've got the apothecary, is usually a man. But occasionally, I found record in the 1300s of a woman who took over the apothecary's shop and was dispensing when her husband died. Because at that point, you could just step into your husband's shoes. You could as a surgeon as well, if it was your husband or your father. I hate to think about that.
I know, I hope you've been following the rand.
And you've got, so usually the physician and the surgeon are men. The leech is most likely a man, but he didn't go to university. So he's educated in the leech books. He's obviously reading it. There's the instructions for the sealing wax and how to write the bill and some of them. So the leech is, and leech really translates as herbalist. And then when you come into the 1800s and Dr. Coffin comes over from America with his wholesale botanic medicine, which is completely the opposite of what we've practiced before and what we practice now, which is very much personal medicine, you suddenly seem to have a lot of men involved with shops. So not an apothecary now, but a herbalist. And druggists and chemists. And women make slow progress going into being a chemist. So it's quite a complicated picture. And all the way through, you've got women as midwives.
Yeah.
And the midwife knew her herbs as well.
And so, do you think...
not to say anything about nurses.
Right, yeah. And would the surgeons then, would they have been working separately to the nurses? Because now obviously you think surgeons and nurses work together, but that's not...
I think probably mostly the family looked after them. Nurses as such come in fairly late and are very badly treated the whole time. There's nothing new in that. And I've been a nurse. and a long time ago, it was a desperate situation as far as, you know, we were understaffed and underpaid. And yes, enough said about that because it's just awful. But there is, in the 1800s, nurses were expected to live in. They didn't have holidays. They weren't expected to get married.
Living in a hospital,
and they had a beer allowance and a meal allowance. Yeah, so it sort of followed from nuns looking after as really being nurses and apothecaries as well, and then other people, and it was sort of looked upon, well, if you weren't likely to get married, one of the ways that you could sort of save yourself was to be a nurse. Or if you weren't up to doing anything else, you know, which is a really sad way of looking at things. And it doesn't give them the credit that they deserved for very hard work.
Who would they be treating? What kind of cases would they be treating at the hospitals?
Well, hospitals would take, for instance, well, there is the smallpox hospital, which William Woodville was in charge of in London. So often it would be something like an infectious disease.
Okay.
That went to a hospital, and that's how ambulances started out, because people were giving it to other people on the way there, and so the ambulance was to sort of keep you isolated and somebody warning people. But then everybody living round a hospital started complaining because the sewage was not what it is today.
Yes.
So
have you found that there's been, there was a difference between, a big change when the Industrial Revolution happened, between how people practiced and how people lived before? And I mean, I'm saying yes, probably. But...
Really, I mean, the biggest change comes with hygiene. And you can't beat that. But in early times, they had a lot more hygiene than we think, and then it seemed to go wrong later on. Medieval, for instance, if you were sitting around a table with people, you were cutting something to hand out or to take your own piece, when you take your own piece, you put your finger in the middle of the piece that you're going to eat, and you cut either side of it and lift it out. You haven't touched anybody else's. And there's lots of rules about table manners for the wealthier person. Obviously, the poorer one didn't necessarily do that. But, they did know. But somehow things go downhill. And then we find Victorian period, an awful lot of pollution, contamination with things, and the death rate goes right back to the medieval, when it's been really good in the 1700s. But you've got a lot of people go from the areas in the country into the towns, and that is where herbal knowledge really gets lost. I think it's the Industrial Revolution more than anything that took it away from people because they no longer had the things that they would have picked available.
And I guess it went in the same communities and things of to be able to go to the
Exactly.
people that they knew.
There's no lady of the manor, there's no village herbalist. She wouldn't have gone with them. And so then you're at the mercy, really, of whatever happens. And often, I mean, such opium use that often one mother would be looking after a whole lot of women's babies, and it was cheaper to actually give them opiates than it was to feed them,
Well.
and it kept them quiet. And so, you know, they didn't stand a chance, really. It's a very sad period in the Victorian times because there was so much heroic medicine coming from mainstream medicine, which is now separated out from the herbal. But for a long period of history, it's the same story. And then along the way, chemistry comes more into the fore from Paracelsus on, really. And gradually, the herbs get pushed back and start being taken out of the pharmacopoeia. But William Woodville, who was the writing a materia medica for physicians and head of the smallpox hospital, he says that he cannot see the evidence that the chemical medicine has better results than the botanic. But nevertheless, they follow on with the chemical medicine.
And then that's kind of how it's continued.
And that's 1790. But a lot of herbs still in the pharmacopoeia up until about 1932.
Right, yeah, that's quite late on. I think we kind of think that it was lost a long time ago, but I mean, yeah, it's interesting. I just think it's interesting how like we look backwards and we kind of just think everybody was so what's the word? Like they didn't know anything, for example, or they were savages or whatever. And I think it's interesting because it's not true. But I think
It's
people
really not
and
true.
lived a lot differently than we're kind of generally led to believe. And
Yes.
I wonder why this is like that is the case. Why we're led to believe this? I don't know.
Well, yeah, I find it really sad. I have obviously grown up children now, grown up grandchildren now. And COVID was a really good time. because the only way I could see my youngest grandson was for us to go for a walk together. And so he actually went to places he had no idea existed, just within walking distance of the house. And he learned about trees and really got quite interested. And he hasn't been that interested since he was little, when I would take him into the dispensary and I'd open a jar and he would smell the dried herb, and then we'd go in the garden and we'd find the fresh one. And I would talk about them with him. And he knew the herbs then. And he would go out. And if I sent him to pick something, he would always go to the marshmallow. That was always favourite. And I'd see him out there stroking it and saying, "Oh, marshmallow." And then we went on a walk during COVID. And we passed a burdock. So I took him to it and we talked about it. And I said, "You just feel the leaf." And, "Oh, it's like marshmallow." So then he decided to take the leaf on the walk with us. And he carried on holding it. So you can sort of restore the links, but a lot of the time it's the phone rather than seeing what's around them. So I'm a great one. Teaching at the School of Herbal Medicine, which is in Bridgewater, I teach pharmacognosy, which is to me incredibly important to all herbalists, because this is about quality control and understanding the herb and knowing when it's right, when it's dried, and recognizing the fresh herbs as well, and making a herbarium with the samples. And the school is very much face-to-face teaching and touch and feel pharmacy. So the students at the end of 6 years know very well the botany, the pharmacy and pharmacognosy, as well as the materia medica and everything else that they need to know about the human body and giving herbal medicine. So it's a really hands-on thing and using your senses. And that, of course, is the big difference between nowadays and all through history. Observation has been the key. When I teach history, we start with the classical period and we go through all the things that Hippocrates and Galen set out that you must know about the patient. And the students love it because it really is setting a pattern that you can follow now, because we do actually have the time, the doctor doesn't.
Yeah.
And it feeds into materia medica and therapeutics. Yes. And I think that what I've just said about setting out how to approach the patient and that personal discovery of them, you know, their environment. Where do they live? Do they live in a nice, airy, healthy place? Or do they live at somewhere that's next to the river and really damp? Do they have mold in the house? You know, all of these questions about which way the wind blows, even. Mm-hmm. Is it usually a southerly or a northerly or an easterly wind? All of that is relevant. And I have them write about what they would like to take from the classical period into their practice in the history session as a homework.
Right.
And that is always inspiring to see what they take from it. And the first year I taught it, I took the essays to Susan Vassar and Maggie Pope started the school because they were concerned that there wasn't the hands-on with the herbs that there should be. And so I said to Susan, "If you want to know why we're teaching history and that it is necessary, this proves it." Because every class I've had over the last 7 years has related completely to that. And does take things from the history and really appreciate them as part of being a herbalist.
And so if people want to like come and study with you or connect with you, who were not going to do a long herbalist course, how would they do that?
Well, there's my website, which is simply my name, christinastapley.co.uk, and they can email me from that. There's the workshops at the Wealden Down and Living Museum. At the moment, I am designing a herb garden to teach the temperaments of the herbs. So the heating, cooling, drying, moistening aspects of the herbs. I'm doing that with a colleague and friend, and she lives in the Cotswolds, and they've just bought a big house with a couple of acres of ground, and we're laying out this garden. She is connected with Unani Tib medicine, which she has studied after training in the Western alongside me. And we're hoping to take some workshops there as well and bring in those aspects more, because the humoral aspect of our medicine has sort of gone under the carpet for a while, and we're bringing it back out. So it comes round, really, the sort of the Greek, a lot of it is lost, but then it comes back through the Arabic medicine. They have it translated, and then it comes back through Salerno and Avicenna. And so there's an awful lot to be gained from how Avicenna looks at Galen and interprets it.
I love that
It's
because,
really fascinating.
but I always find that everybody always talks about Chinese medicine and they always talk about Ayurvedic medicine, but nobody ever talks about like kind of Unani Tib and that. And it has obviously had such a big influence on British herbalism or
It
Western
has,
herbalism.
absolutely. So I've taken Arabic workshops, not in Arabic, I used to say, but on Arabic medicine and how the Arabic pharmacy particularly influenced our pharmacy. And I look at that in the book and look at recipes and has this changed and are we seeing syrups and aromatic waters coming in? Because I love the aromatic waters. I distill some aromatic waters myself, and for others I go to Avicenna. That's Jonas's Avicenna, not Avicenna. And they're a wonderful way of giving the medicine. So you can put them into hand baths or foot baths. You can apply them to the pulse. You can put them into a bottle of water, tell the patient to take the water to work, and they just sip it through the day. There's all sorts of ways that you can use aromatic waters.
My
They
gran
are
uses,
really
she
good.
has like rose water that she just would put into everything. Like she'd make a lemonade rose water, and anything she would make, she'd pour
Yes.
rose water in it. But
Well, yesterday I was candying flowers. So primroses largely, some of my orange blossom and cowslips. And I do that with a tablespoon of rose water goes into the little jar first, and then a teaspoon of gum arabic, and you put the lid on and shake it like mad, and then each flower is dipped in that and then coated in sugar. And they keep wonderfully. I'm taking a workshop on our native herbs in the summer. As flowers, but not just flowers, the herbs themselves as fragrances, as flavors, and for fitness. So I'm very much at the moment coming to put the focus on the native herbs this year, and the temperament garden that I'm doing with Ruth Mannion Daniels is actually also we decided, with Salim Khan's approval from the college, that it would be of the native herbs. rather than try to do herbs from Avicenna. Mm-hmm. Many of those we can't grow.
Yeah.
But understanding our native herbs is important, and we are the guardians of them. And one of the things that, although I'm encouraging people to think about them for putting flavours into cookery, things that you wouldn't normally think about putting flavours into cookery with, there's also a danger with foraging that people who don't really understand plants get encouraged and will take too many from places. And so we are now custodians of our native plants, and that's a responsibility for the herbalists, I think, to take on board.
Yeah,
I've always
yeah.
grown my own cowslips.
I think we hear that a lot from the American herbalists, I think, because they've kind of, it's like they're a bit ahead of us in that way of the wildcrafting has already destroyed so many areas. And I think we don't hear it a lot over enough here.
And we do have to think about it. And that's part of my pharmacognosy class, is looking at what are protected plants. And when you go to gather, don't just think about contaminants from farm sprays or water runoff from fields and that sort of thing, or the road. You think, is this supporting the wildlife around it? And are you leaving a sustainable amount?
Mm-hmm.
As well as, is the plant at the right maturity to gather, etc.?
Yeah. It's interesting because we're just putting on some like workshops and films about herbs and climate change. And I've been trying to find, and there's like loads and loads and loads of films about climate change and food, but there's just nothing about herbs and how it's affecting them or how they're being affected. Or any of the effects with herbs. It's just interesting.
Worries me is things like many more trees, like elder, hawthorn, I have seen, with pernicious fruiting. So you've got fruit and blossom on the same branch. And that sort of makes you worry. The hormones are evidently confused. And so what's it done to the other constituents?
Mm-hmm. I've been noticed that with the elder, actually. Some of them strangely have the both at the same time. Yeah.
It's happened odd times in the past because you get legends about it.
Right, okay.
There are beliefs that when that happens on a particular tree, like hawthorn, then there's going to be a death in the family. No, I think it's blackthorn. There's going to be a death in the family.
Okay.
Or something like that. So it's like primroses being out when they shouldn't be foretells a disaster, which actually in 1986 did, because the tree came down in the Great Gale over the top of it. And I said, well, I can see where this came from.
But that again shows the thing of like observation, doesn't it? Because like you would then look about whether it's happened, just if it's a one-off or if it starts happening year on year on year.
Yes. So some things are happening more, and I encourage everybody to make a diary of the garden and how things are responding.
Mm-hmm.
And I do, temperatures that you wouldn't expect. Yesterday it was 24 in the conservatory, just with the sun. Can't go there today, but in the morning there was a frost.
Yeah.
So that's really not good for anything.
Yeah.
Quite difficult for the plants with the temperature just sort of seesawing up and down.
Yeah. Okay, on that happy topic.
I think, we don't give plants enough credit for what they can adapt to.
Yeah. Well, what
as,
I wonder
as a
is,
positive statement.
Yeah. I mean, I kind of think the plants are probably going to adapt probably better than we will, is what I think.
Yes.
So they've been here a lot longer than we have. So
that's right. And they've been through great changes before.
Yeah, exactly.
And trees particularly. And of course I've included the trees greatly in the last few years because I wrote the two books on the medicinal uses of the trees, but they have, some of them lived for hundreds and hundreds of years. And so they've seen cycles of changes in temperature and rainfall before. And so, so I think it's some in Germany are showing signs that they are adapting to what's happening.
Right.
And so we look forward to seeing perhaps some things here adapting better.
Excellent.
It's not all a bad story.
No. Well, thank you very much. It's been, I really enjoyed this chat. It's been really good. Thanks so
Well,
much for
thank
coming.
you.